Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for being with us on this Thursday afternoon. Our guest today is West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. He's in our studios. We'd love to have your questions for him during our next half hour. You can call those in to area code 765-496-1999. You can email questions to ask@wbaa.org, and you can tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. I expected to see you clean-shaven when you walked in here. The last couple of Novembers, you've come in and you've done this whole solidarity thing and not shaved. Yeah. That was nice. And you've still got the facial hair on.
Well, you see what's going on is it's starting to turn a little gray.
I noticed that. I didn't want to mention that.
Yeah, you can't see this out in radio land, but it gives me that look of sophistication that my personality can't necessarily back up.
I'm not sure that's the look you're giving.
Well, Mary likes it, too. That's another big
there
bonus.
You go. That's
there
like,
you
the,
go.
The wife is a fan. Okay, so that's why. Let's get into the questions that have come in from the listeners. Scott has written in since you were last on the show. He says, I'm delighted the River Road project is almost done. Mm-hmm. Will the timing of the stoplights at the different intersections be adjusted? Right now, he says it can take up to 5 minutes to get from Robinson to State Street.
Hmm. Absolutely. A lot of that stuff, I mean, there's this great big mystery about traffic flow and about how streetlights work and what the timing's predicated on and which roads have priority and all this stuff. A lot of that timing specifically on River Road has been sort of chalked up a little bit because of other projects that we've had going on. What they'll do, as soon as everything's flowing and open and flowing, we can go ahead and do some timing studies to see what kind of, you know, efficiencies the roundabouts have done to make sure that what we've done right there at State Street, the intersection of State Street and River Road proper, is suitable for the traffic flow that we've had, and then we can make the appropriate adjustments. But always. And one of the biggest challenges people have in actually comprehending, always, peak traffic times are always going to dictate the times on the lights. And the sad side of that is the lights don't yet have the technology to be able to scope and see how many cars are actually in line. So depending upon where the loops are, depending upon how the signalization goes, it can be kind of a challenge to make sure that, like on Christmas Day, you don't have to wait that same period of time for vehicles to get through when they're basically non-existent. And college communities kind of had that unique challenge because with the influx and the exiting of our students during holidays and during summer, sometimes the communities don't necessarily have that kind of agility to get those lights adjusted without having to go through a bunch of different channels, even more importantly when it intersects with a state road. When you're dealing with a state road, you know, the state obviously is the higher tier when it comes to those kind of conversations, and it becomes a bit more of a challenge.
You have talked on this program about having people come in and computerize the way that all of your signals mm-hmm. work and things like that. Is that something that you will eventually have the ability to do in this instance?
Mm-hmm. Sure. When you see like these little cutouts on the street, that those are loops, they're traffic loops, and they're actually pieces of technology that can communicate to a transmitter that would allow for us at a remote location to make adjustments on that. As we touch intersections, we're putting those in. So the eventuality is, like what we have on Salisbury Street, I believe, the eventuality is will be for us to be able to go ahead and time lights as traffic flow it either increases or decreases, like during holidays or during our rush hours here in West Lafayette. Because we're really strong believers in making sure that we have some sort of control, some sort of coordinated control over our traffic flow. Back in the old days, the only thing that they could use was actually the traffic signalization, the stoplights and the stop signs. Now we can move forward into using technology to allow for us to make traffic flow more smoothly. Most specifically on Salisbury Street, where there seems to be from about 3 o'clock every weekday, there's just this long line of traffic that basically starts at 52 and sometimes goes as far back as Lindbergh. And the reasoning for that is because the lights aren't timed and they're not in a position to be physically manipulated to where they can let the traffic flow go so that it can get squeezed out basically. But we are putting the loops in. We're getting the software packages that will empower for us to be able to do that. So hypothetically, if a firefighter at Station 2 sees that things are backed up, he can either text one of our engineers or make a phone call, and we can go ahead and get that traffic signalized to go through the intersection safely.
Someone else has called in and said the sidewalks on North Sheets Street are in bad shape. There are lots of holes in them. Will the city please address this issue?
Sure. Pretty easily done, huh?
So what will you do? I mean, what do you have to do in a case like that? If you get a call like this that says the sidewalks are bad in one place, mm-hmm. is that something you can just leap to changing?
Well, what we do, and again, you know, government isn't necessarily and probably by design the most efficient way to get things done. Oftentimes when you say just give your local representative or give your local mayor a call, the presumption is that it takes great time and great patience in order to get things done. And unfortunately, for the most part, that's kind of true. But what we do as an entity is we always do street and sidewalk surveys. And we prioritize those issues in a capital plan. And then we obviously go ahead and do them when we can. That's why a lot of times you'll see a road crew, for those of you in radio, I just knocked over my water. Sorry about that. A road crew will be working on a road that didn't seem to be too bad, whereas the road right next to it is horrible. And again, that's because we've gone ahead and done the necessary budgeting things to get that funding so we can do that road. But when it comes to sidewalks, it's a little bit different. Sidewalks are an immediate hazard. And we have some equipment that allows for us to either jack up the concrete pads to make them more safe or sand them down if they're buckled so that you can get a stroller or a wheelchair over it. Or in the event that they're really torn up, go ahead and just replace them as needed. It's not necessarily a comprehensive, for instance, we couldn't do an entire street without having a more involved plan and obviously having more capital directed towards that plan. But generally, we can be relatively responsive when we're aware of the fact that there is an issue involving personal safety for folks. So,
same person, by the way, says bike lanes would be an asset on Indian Trail Drive. They say many families bike there and they are very much needed.
So. Well, yep, we're on that too. But the unfortunate reality about bike trails is, you know, we're transitioning. We're getting to be a more pedestrian community again as we were about a century ago. But the unfortunate fact of that is that in the interim, we built a bunch of roads. And, you know, in the 50s and 60s and 70s when cars were the best way to get around and gas was cheap and, you know, you get your driver's license at 16, 1 month and 1 day, the roads were designed to move cars efficiently and effectively. Sidewalks were where you basically walked on. So the roads had the priorities. They had all the space. They had all the easements. And now we're going sort of to a different level to where we're encouraging bikes, we're encouraging runners, we're encouraging people to walk. And so that kind of sort of, I guess, reversely segues into what I was talking about a minute ago. As we get the funding, when we touch trails, when we get on roads, we go ahead and make sure that we have that designation. And where we don't have the right-of-way or we can't afford to purchase the right-of-way, we do the painted lines that's specifically dedicated towards bikes. And then in the other case scenarios where geographically we don't have the size to do either, we have those sharrows where you see the bicycle thing with the hair, that's a share where cars and bikes are directed to share the same lane safely.
I have to say those things scare the dickens out of me.
I
understand the usefulness of them, but when riding my bike through an area that has sharrows, I cannot escape the idea that this says the bike and the car are legally allowed to occupy the same space. And not being a physics major, I realize still the car is much larger than I am on my bike.
There's this guy, and I haven't seen him for a while, but he has a bicycle that's encased in this spherical looking.
I think I know the person you're talking
about. Yeah, it looks like a car. And so he's riding in the car lane, then he shifts to the bike lane, and then when we get to the Sharrow, he comes back out. And this is specifically between Navajo and 52. He does that, which bicyclists are supposed to do. And it's funny because he's got some electronics on there that help him indicate the direction that he's going. And it's kind of neat. But for the longest time, just seeing him go down the road, I always thought he was a car, but it's a bicyclist.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're talking today with Mayor John Dennis of West Lafayette. Call in your questions to 765-496-1999. Email them to ask@wbaa.org or tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, we talked on last month's program about, with both you and Mayor Wazworski, about the proposed needle exchange program. The commissioners, by a 2-1 vote, have now approved a go-forward with that to ask the state whether we would be able to declare the public health emergency, which would be the next step to getting the needle exchange program. But it came out in our two programs with you and Mayor Wazworski that you guys are very, very much in different places on this thing. You guys have differing views on it. You say you're for it. Mayor Wazworski says he's not sure how he could be for it. He's very worried about it bringing more drug users to the community when he's already facing a lot of drug crime. He says he's not sure where it could be put safely, that it wouldn't endanger a neighborhood. We had tape of him that Chris Marisevica gathered a couple weeks ago, actively admonishing people from IU Arnett Health, saying, "All right, well, you guys house it at the hospital then, because I don't want it in one of my neighborhoods." And Chris said he was as agitated in public as she had ever seen him in many years of covering him. And so I wanted to ask you about the disconnect. Is it a problem going forward for the needle exchange program if the two communities, and we should say the administrations broadly, because the police feel very differently about this too.
Is it
a problem to have that disconnect if we want this thing to be successful?
I don't think so. I mean, first off, I've known Tony. We've been close friends for over 30 years. He loves his community as I do mine. He is not, I'm not going to put words in Tony's mouth, but I know where his heart is. His heart isn't to try and do harm. His heart is trying to do the right thing for his community. And there are areas in Lafayette that are under a great deal of stress right now. And the possibility is strong that if you provide some option in there, it could further that stress and could have a contributing factor to the demise of a neighborhood. So I understand where he's coming from. But we are in a different state now, societally. We need to look at ways to provide help, guidance, and possibly some curative guidance about people that are in situations that aren't necessarily something that we're familiar with, hence the needle exchange program. And it's not just a needle exchange program. It's the whole kit. I mean, you get all kinds of stuff with the program.
Sure, they're calling it a syringe services program.
There you go.
Yes.
Even more politically correct, I guess. But In some of the conversations that I've had with folks, because again, you know, Tony and I can disagree on things, but, you know, we disagree because we're in different components of the community right now. But the thought of having the needle exchange program is good. You know, would I want one over here? I don't know. I don't know if it would be proper. I don't know that it would, if it would serve the need for folks who are actually trying to get that service.
Now, hang on a second. Are you saying that your feeling is different if it's located in Lafayette versus if it's located in West Lafayette?
No, I just don't know how effective it's going to be. It's not location. I think the whole purpose is to try and reach as many people as you possibly can. That's why what I was thinking about is, what about having a mobile clinic? What about using an ambulance or using some retired emergency vehicle?
And we should say this is something other counties have, in fact, done.
Oh, well, geez, I thought it was just my great idea. Just kidding.
But go ahead.
But anyway, but making it mobile, providing some sort of advance notice and having remote locations all around the community to where you can better serve the population that's feeling the greatest need. I have done a lot of work with drugs and drug addicts. When I was a police officer, you know, I worked with the drug task force on both sides of the river.
This to me is, by the way, is one of the major reasons it's interesting that you and Mayor Wazworski are so different on this, is because you both come from that law enforcement background and diverge on this topic.
And based upon my experience, I know that the need isn't going to solve, the problem isn't going to solve itself, and the need isn't going to get less. The biggest challenge that we would have, even with a needle exchange program, is making sure that those needles aren't reused. I mean, again, hypothetically speaking, somebody gets a kit, they go ahead and utilize it. Somebody next to them needs to have the same device to inject drugs into their system. What's to prevent that from being passed off?
Or indeed, as we've heard from some other places, sold by drug users for cash or exchanged for heroin to sustain that habit, as we've heard might be happening down in Scott County where this whole thing began.
Oh, yeah, sure. And communicable diseases are a problem regardless, whether it's Hep C, whether it's HIV, all that. We have a huge problem with that, and a lot of that is because of some of our underserved communities don't have access to proper devices to assist them in getting some of those, you know, dealing with the immediate problem and then hopefully putting them in a situation where they will have access to mental health care, to health care, to, you know, some sort of maybe psychological services, but some professionals to teach them how to not use, abuse, or you know, be involved with drugs.
And I know that's
kind of Pollyanna-esque, but again, there has to be an intake system with that.
So let me ask, as far as intake goes, do you share Mary Rozworsky's worry about the fact that more drug users could come to the greater Lafayette area, especially from surrounding counties that do not have a syringe services program, because this would be the nearest one to them? He says one of his worries is that you are just going to increase the base number of drug users, needle users, who will be in this community for one reason or another.
That is a distinct possibility. It's true. It's a distinct possibility. But you also share at least some of the burden of what if not, you know, if not this, what? How do we treat, you know, a drug problem? How do you treat a problem about, you know, an ongoing, like I say, a health crisis as they're looking at getting the county sanctioned under? You know, we as elected officials have to figure out how to deal with these issues. You know, I mean, we can have all the undercover police officers that we want working on drug task forces, and that isn't necessarily going to solve the problem. The weird thing about injecting drugs is that when it goes from person to person, regardless of what you're using, you know, you could be some folks, you know, are so desperate they use straws to inject drugs into their systems. You know, I've seen how, you know, households are kept from folks that are involved with drugs to that level. You run into great challenges that go far beyond just something as benevolent as a needle exchange program, because human nature is a lot different than specifically when you're dealing with addicts, a lot different than those of us that are trying to craft policy and procedures to try and correct things. And because of those controls aren't necessarily there, you know, I think that it's incumbent upon us as humans to try and look after each other in the best way that we know how.
Is there an added danger to having a syringe services program near a major college campus like this one? Because let's face it, college kids have, for generation upon generation, mm-hmm. been wont to do things with illicit substances mm-hmm. to try new stuff, whether that's good for them or not. Mm-hmm. Is it a bad idea to make potentially the accoutrement with which they could try those illicit substances more available in such a community?
Well, it would be naive for any of us to think that that doesn't already exist. You know, there, since the 60s, experimentation with mind-altering substances has become very popular, and it's very popular with a specific age group. And oftentimes it doesn't recognize, you know, educational demographics, race, creed, anything like that. It's just an alternative source for entertainment. Sometimes it's recreational, and sometimes it gets to become more of a personal problem. And it's funny because, again, my law enforcement time is now a decade old. I've been doing this thing for a while. But in my experience, I have seen situations that are shocking. You would think, you know better than that, or you were raised better than that. One of the things that my father used to always tell me. But you're surprised at what the attraction is for folks to get themselves involved in a situation that they cannot easily get out of, drugs being one of them. So having it readily available, I mean, that's kind of an interpretive term. I mean, if you can go and knock on your next door neighbor's house and get, you know, name that tune when it comes to drugs, that could be a problem, but also I know that in some situations within this community that already exists.
Let me ask you one law enforcement question, then we'll move on to another topic or two. If you were a police officer, mm-hmm. could you go to sit outside in your squad car, wherever the place is where they're distributing the needles, mm-hmm. and follow the people who walk out having made an exchange? Is that profiling? Is that legal? Is it something you could do to address both the public health side of it and the potential for increased crime that Mayor Rozworsky is worried about?
I think it would be chicken or the egg. I think if there's a police car in front of a distribution point, that's really going to lower the traffic that goes in there.
All right, so let's assume that it's plain clothes or something.
Well, if you're
going
to make all assumptions, let's assume there's no drug problem in the country at all. Nah, not going to do that. No, I don't think that would be if it's kind of hard to answer because we're exploring a hypothetical that I can't imagine, because if you parked police cars in front of the distribution point, you wouldn't have the traffic. But if somebody would go through there, and let's say a police officer is familiar with that person as a burglar or as a drug dealer or as, you know, name that crime, and he decides to follow that person,
but then
the possession of the kid itself isn't necessarily against the law.
So,
but if they go to he goes to his house and he cooks up and he injects, you know, the officer would need a warrant. I mean, there's all this kind of technical stuff that would probably prohibit that from being an immediate eyeline, you know, arrest.
Gotcha. All right.
Now, if he shoots up, you know, right in front of the guy saying, ah, I got this for free, that could be an issue.
We've got just a few minutes left with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis on today's Ask the Mayor program here on WBAA. You can email questions at any time for any of our mayors to ask@WBAA.org or tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. There was a meeting last evening of Purdue faculty, staff, and students to discuss some of these white supremacist posters that have been posted on campus, notably outside some of the departments of the foreign languages and cultures that study here on campus. How is the city prepared to respond to instances of racism, white nationalism, bigotry, and other such behaviors that seem to have been popping up, not just here, but across the country following the election of Donald Trump?
Well, if you go on our website, you can click on our Human Relations Commission link, and you can find everything. We are absolutely 100% committed to making sure that that doesn't occur in our community, and we will take action if we find out that it does. But it's kind of odd because, again, this seems to be my, you know, retrospective on my law enforcement career. But my first introduction to how powerful the right of free speech is happened in the early 90s. Back in the city of Lafayette, we had a visit from the Ku Klux Klan. And we had to take extreme measures to protect the Klan. They set up camp on the courthouse. We had to completely surround the courthouse in concertina wire fence. We had to create basically a corral for the protesters that were going to protest against the Klan. And we had to sit idly by while the Klan spewed out their venomous, poisonous, horrific, horrible messages. I can't even imagine how many thousands of dollars that cost, tens of thousands of dollars that cost the city of Lafayette and Tippecanoe County to get that done. And I remember, again, I was in my late 20s, early 30s, and I said, well, just tell them no. You know, tell them not to come here. Tell them to stay the hell out of our community and go somewhere else to spew their poison. And I was told by the higher-ups, you can't do that. It's their right of free speech. And then I said, well, we don't have to let them go wherever we want. We can make them go into a closet or into a small, you know, no, you can't do that. They have the right to petition. So it was a real quick sort of education. Not only that, but then we also had to provide, you know, security and do intelligence on some of the folks who follow the Klan around. They've got a group of folks that are, you know, they follow them everywhere they go, and they are the counter to the Klan.
Okay, so a lot of this will come back to a First Amendment debate.
Are we running out of time?
A little bit.
Okay.
A lot of this will come back to a First Amendment debate. And what's the difference between free speech and hate speech? Mm-hmm. What's the difference between freedom of expression and overriding the right to peaceably assemble? Mm-hmm. And just as much as you are protected by the First Amendment, if you run afoul of it,
sure,
the First Amendment will not be your friend.
Correct.
Where does your law enforcement draw the line in cases like that to determine what is not peaceably assembled, what is hate speech instead of the free speech that is granted by the Constitution?
Our men and women on the West Lafayette Police Department have enough common sense to recognize what those tolerances are. And they will take aggressive action if they feel the proverbial screaming fire in the crowded theater starts to take place. You know, acts of violence, overt, you know, inflammatory language towards folks.
I have to ask,
folks,
have they taken a position on these posters yet that have shown up on the Purdue campus?
I don't know, because that's Purdue's jurisdiction. I know what we've done in the past. I mean, there have been some pretty nasty things just stapled to telephone poles, and they'll go ahead and pull them down. The other side is, a couple years ago, there was a Confederate flag hanging in one of the windows of one of the apartments on campus, and there was just a request made. So in West Lafayette, yes, we're pretty alerted to things like that, and we're pretty sensitive to the needs of our citizenry. And we try to respond in a way that's going to be, you know, the best thing we ever do is we've got a very professional group of men and women who use the power of suggestion first.
Let me ask you about one more topic in just our last couple of minutes here. There's a conference today at Purdue that's announcing a new institute where the university is trying to focus some of its resources on helping the defense sector going forward even more than Purdue already does. And Purdue already gets tens of millions of dollars to do defense research on behalf of the U.S. government and private corporations. And I was talking with the interim director this morning, and one of the things he said to me that was interesting was, in the coming years, we could see more unmanned aerial vehicles, drones, military drones flying around as some of that research is done. And I wondered if you thought that you would have to sort of have a conversation with the community about what this means to see these things that, let's face it, in some parts of the country are bringers of death and have been and have brought a lot of criticism down on the current presidential administration for their use. Do you think that you'd have to have some sort of conversation about when these things are flown or how or how high to keep the public from freaking out?
Well, again, you've already told me I can't tell any more stories because we're running out of time, but I've experienced that before. And I know a lot of times people make the presumption that Big Brother has some sort of recording devices everywhere. Anymore, in all honesty, you look at parking lots, you look at areas in front of banks and areas in front of businesses, cameras are everywhere. And oftentimes now when police officers are doing investigations, one of the first things they ask the vendor, do you have a camera? And that's even getting down to the point now where they're asking homeowners that when they've had burglaries, do you have a camera in the house? Do you have a camera in the perimeter of the house? So I think societally, I think we're getting kind of used to the fact that we're under the eye. But I agree with you in the sense that we need to be cautious about some of these, the perception of a flying drone, the perception of a military-looking aerial vehicle that has an image of violence or aggression. And I think it would be in all of our best interest to understand what's going on out there.
Do you worry at all that as Purdue tries to position itself as a leader in defense research, that it puts it at all a target on the university, on the city, because we are trying to position ourselves as we are a leading place that this happens? But I wonder if you think that's at all a double-edged sword, because now we're saying publicly you should send a bunch of money from the federal government, from DARPA, places like that, to Purdue to do this research where we have very smart people who can do it. But aren't you at some point telling potential enemies, hey,
blow
by the
up.
Way, it's happening right here.
Here we go. We have actually had this conversation for years because we have a nuclear plant here. Some of the research that goes on at Purdue University uses chemicals, chemistry, and products of those chemicals and chemistry that are pretty nasty. The type, I wouldn't necessarily say it's weaponry, but there's a lot of stuff that goes on any research university that has that potential. If people were to decide that they wanted to take any kind of an aggressive action against X, whatever that product or device might be, there is a security plan for that. I'm sure if you were to speak to Chief Cox, he could give you, well, he probably couldn't tell you because, you know, double super secret stuff, but he could let you know that there are protocols to respond in the event something like that should occur. So, you know, I, strategically speaking, I think that most universities are challenged that way. But here in West Lafayette, I think that we're in a position to be able to handle those threats.
All right. Well, Mr. Mayor, thanks as always. Happy holidays to you. Merry Christmas.
Back
Happy
at
New
you.
Year. And we'll see you in January.
All right. I'll be here.
All right. This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember to tune in at this time next week for our conversation with Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski. And you can find all of these shows at our website. That's WBAA.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Encompass Credit Union, supporting Ask the Mayor and offering a full line of financial services to the people of Clinton and Tipton counties while supporting the communities they serve. More information at EncompassCU.org.